Support for this podcast of The Exchange is brought to you by the Dagoba Group, a global diversity and inclusion consulting practice with specialties in unconscious bias, leadership dynamics, and client engagement. Authors of the book, The Inclusion Dividend. More at thedagobagroup.com.
And Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto, home, and personal loans. Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Opportunity.
And Dartmouth Hitchcock, creating a new model for healthcare where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us. A sustainable system improving the health of our communities for years to come. Information at imagine.d-h.org. That's imagine.dh.org.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. Welcome to a special First in the Nation primary edition of The Exchange. This hour, Republican presidential candidate and former high-tech executive Carly Fiorina is with us. Fiorina is best known for reaching the executive suite of Hewlett-Packard, often describing her story as a hard-fought climb from secretary to CEO. She also holds impressive degrees, an undergraduate from Stanford and a master's from the MIT Sloan School of Management. On the political front, her resume may be slim. She ran unsuccessfully for the U.S. Senate in California, but in this year's anti-establishment political climate, that can come across as an asset. In fact, Fiorina casts herself as an outsider, insisting that Americans are tired of the so-called political class. Today in The Exchange, for the next 40 minutes, we're sitting down with Carly Fiorina, and in addition to taking questions from me and Josh Rogers, we'll hear from our live audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. They'll be submitting questions as well. And Josh, let's begin with you.
Good morning. Let's start with guns. President Obama's new executive action includes requiring gun sellers, including those who do business on the internet and at gun shows, to be licensed and to conduct background checks on buyers. You've called his actions unconstitutional and dangerous. You've said that we need to enforce existing laws rather than enact new ones. What specific laws do you feel aren't being enforced?
Well, many of the ones that President Obama talked about in his speech. You know, the reason I called this action lawless is because, of course, many gun dealers already are subject to the actions that he took. He's talking about people who perhaps have a family collection. But Congress has rejected this exact prescription twice on a bipartisan basis. And the last time I looked, in our Constitution, the president doesn't get to enact laws. That's the job of Congress. But secondly, in his speech, what he talked about was finally actually adding FBI agents or ATF agents to make sure that the rules and the laws that are in place get followed. So, for example, Dylann Roof, the murderer who charged into a South Carolina church, Dylann Roof should never have been sold a gun. The FBI admits this. And yet, somehow he slipped through the cracks. It's also true that in a city like Chicago that has some of the strictest gun laws in the country, we also have the highest rates of gun violence. Why? Because criminals who shouldn't own guns have them. And this administration has prosecuted less than 1% of the criminals who shouldn't own guns that they know about, instead of taking those guns out of the hands of people who shouldn't own them and who are using them to commit murder and mayhem.
But so in your watch, the public could expect greater resources put into enforcing
existing
laws.
Yes, absolutely. Let's make sure that we are conducting the background checks. They're part of law today. Let's make sure that we're prosecuting every criminal who owns a gun who shouldn't own a gun. Let's make sure that we're enforcing the laws we have. You know, it's interesting. I'm going to be addressing the State House later today. And New Hampshire, of course, has a concealed carry law. And I'm perfectly comfortable going into the State House knowing that there are many New Hampshire representatives who will be carrying their weapons with them. Law-abiding citizens have an individual right to bear arms. And that's something that the people of New Hampshire have upheld over and over and over again. Sadly, I think this president continues to politicize tragedy, unfortunately.
Well, so what do you make of polling that indicates that, a high majority of the public supports so-called universal background checks, that that fails when put to vote in Washington.
Well, that's right. It fails when put to a vote in Washington. So what that suggests is that perhaps representatives are hearing from their constituents. Put it to the test. Pass the law. But the reality is these measures have been rejected on multiple occasions by bipartisan majorities in the House and the Senate.
Well, I mean, you've also said on the campaign trail that you would like to be – that if you were president, you'd be responsive to the will of the people. I haven't heard you talk about this much lately, but earlier on the campaign you talked about, you know, creating ways in which voters could contact you directly either via an app or some sort of text messaging, polling. You know, if you were president and the majority of people said, you know, I would support background checks, you know, would you support them? I mean, I guess what I'm asking is a philosophical question about leadership. I mean, if you were elected, I mean, do you believe it's the president's duty to do the will of the people or to exercise their judgment having been duly elected?
It is not the president's job to enact laws. It is Congress's job to enact laws. That's what our Constitution says. And this president seems to forget that over and over again. I talked last night in Exeter at the Exeter Town Hall, famous setting where Abraham Lincoln once spoke, packed them in. And I talked exactly about using an app for citizen government. But here's how I would use it. I believe, for example, that we need to finally pass a 20-year-old plan for a 3-page tax code. We have a 73,000-page tax code today. That level of complexity benefits the rich, the big, the powerful, the well-connected, and it disadvantages the small business owner, for example, and the powerless, a working family. So we need to finally pass that plan. The way I'm going to put pressure on Congress to get it passed is to go into the Oval Office on a regular basis, ask people to take out their smartphones and say, do you agree with me that Congress ought to finally pass that 20-year-old plan for a 3-page tax code? Press 1 for yes, 2 for no. There actually is an app for citizen government. I'm not going to pass that law myself. That's not my role as president. But I can focus and leverage the common sense and the good judgment and indeed the anger and the frustration of the American people on their elected representatives so that they enact the will of the people.
Well, but back to guns for 1 second.
I know you disagree with me, clearly.
No. I'm curious about, but I mean, I'm just trying to get it. It's Congress's job to pass laws, and that's obvious. But polling has shown that, you know, there's a poll, CBS News, New York Times in October that found 92% of Americans, including, according to this poll, 87% of Republicans favored background checks on all gun purchases.
Well, then Congress ought to pass that law. But what the president cannot do, what the president should not do lawfully is say, never mind that Congress has rejected this twice. I'm going to listen to the polls and decide on my own what should be. Just like this president shouldn't have passed an executive order changing the immigration laws. That's not his role, whether he's a Republican or a Democrat, whether she's a Republican or a Democrat. It is not a president's job to pass laws. And this president has overreached his executive authority over and over and over again because, you see, he thinks he knows better than the people and then the elected representatives. I am running for president because I think we have to return to a citizen government. I think we have to take our government back.
But if you were president, I guess what I'm getting at is if you were president and this app, the public told you that it wanted X, Y, Z, would you urge Congress to be responsive to that?
Well, see, let me answer very specifically. I have laid out a blueprint for the things we need to do first to take our country back. And what I'm going to do is use that blueprint to focus on my priorities. So actually, I think it's more important not to pass new laws on guns, but to enforce the laws we have. Actually, I think it's most important to use that app to focus Congress on passing a 3-page tax code, changing the way we spend citizens' money by going to zero-based budgeting, which is a fancy word for how all of us budget at home, finally repealing Obamacare and replacing it with a health care system that will work, securing the border, etc. So I'm going to use that app to focus on the priorities that I think are most important to take our country back. And those are represented in my blueprint, which your listeners can find on CarlyForPresident.com.
Ms. Fiorina, I want to ask about your business background somewhat, because that's the basis of a lot of this campaign. And you've emphasized that you're a political outsider, probably a good thing in this year, and that you come from the business world where, in your words, track records and accomplishments count. When it comes to track records, I do want to ask about yours. And you've talked about this on the campaign trail, that as chief executive officer of Hewlett-Packard, you were forced out of that position. You've in part blamed the collapse of the tech bubble for HP's problems. My question for you, though, Ms. Fiorina, is you were the leader there. Did you play any role in HP's business troubles at that time?
Well, actually, I don't blame the dot-com bust. I was fired in a boardroom brawl that lasted over 2 weeks, and it was over a matter of principle that board members shouldn't be leaking confidential conversations out of the boardroom. The man who led that effort, who was also leaking to the press, is a legendary venture capitalist named Tom Perkins. And about 6 months ago, he took out a full-page ad in the New York Times, unbeknownst to me, that said, Carly was right, I was wrong, the board was dysfunctional, she was a great CEO, she'll make a great president, I'm backing her 1,000%. Here's my track record at HP. I was recruited to that company. That company was deeply troubled. It
from
had grown
AT&T
fat
and
bloated, and it wasn't producing for customers, for shareholders. I took that company in 6 years through the height of the dot-com boom, and then 6 months later we went into the dot-com bust. And despite those very difficult times, we doubled the size of the company to almost $90 billion. We grew top-line revenues at 9%. We quadrupled cash flow. We tripled the rate of innovation to almost 15 patents a day. We went from lagging behind to leading in every single product category in every market segment. I will run on that track record all day long. The only way you go from secretary to CEO in male-dominated fields like communications and technology is you produce. You produce. You lead. You challenge the status quo. You solve festering problems. And you produce results and are held accountable. And that's what I did at Hewlett-Packard, and that's what I will do with the American people, which is why I've laid out a blueprint, because I want to be held accountable for getting that blueprint done. And I want to return to New Hampshire, by the way, in January of 2018 to start the conversation about how are we doing.
So that whole incident of, you know, HP's profits, revenues did go up because HP bought Compaq, but profits fell. That whole boardroom brawl that you describe, and it sounds like a movie.
It was kind of like a movie, believe me.
I mean, leadership is about taking responsibility. Did you play no responsible part in HP's misfortunes?
Well, first of all, I don't accept your premise that HP had misfortunes. I mean, yes, we had went through difficult times. Profits were up, not down. Cash flow was up, not down. Revenue growth rates were up from 1% to 9%. So Hewlett-Packard was saved in the 6 years that I was there. It was a massive team effort. Companies that did not make the necessary changes to transform themselves during those difficult times literally disappeared. Gateway, Sun Microsystems. I mean, there are long lists of technology companies that literally disappeared. Yes, you have to make some tough calls sometimes in tough times. And I actually think the American people want a leader who's prepared to stand up, be held accountable, and make the tough calls in the tough times.
Another tech question for you, Ms. Fiorina. The tech sector came up recently in our national security discussions after San Bernardino, especially, and I'm sure you know where I'm going with this. You've called for companies to tear down cyber walls in order to help law enforcement connect the dots around potential risks. But you've also said that you don't think tech companies should be forced to help the government. They need to be asked. They need to be brought to the table. What if they are asked and they say no? Then what?
Well, first, I don't think that's likely. But here's specifically what I've called for. Number one, there are a number of legal authorities that Congress must pass in order to ensure that public sector networks and private sector networks and people can collaborate together to detect and repel cyber attacks. This is why a Sony Pictures attack happens. We're losing the war in cyberspace, not because we're not the most sophisticated technological nation on the planet, but because we don't have those legal authorities in place, number one. I would get them passed. Number two, because our government is probably seven generations of technology behind. When 2001 occurred and processes were put in place, technologies moved on seven generations. So, for example, there are companies that exist today that didn't exist even 5 years ago that have created far more sophisticated algorithms about how you search through big data. I would ask the public sector to provide that kind of expertise to the
You mean the private sector.
Private
yeah.
sector, to provide that kind of expertise to the public sector. By the
to
way, this is very much
threats.
This is very much what we did in World War II. And by the way, we're not at world war, but we are at war. There's a cyber war going on. ISIS has declared war on us. And so the private sector can do some things that we cannot do. We learned, for example, over the holiday weekend that our government doesn't know who overstays a visa. Wow, that's pretty shocking. We also learned that our government doesn't bother to check public Facebook postings or to routinely check out jihadist websites. This is insanity.
So this is information that the government could get.
Yes, it of course they could get.
That tech companies need to hand it over.
No, I'm not talking about tech companies mm-hmm. handing over citizens' private information. I'm talking about, for example, government acknowledging that technology has moved on generations. Bureaucracies become over time incompetent. Why? Because they're process-intensive, risk-averse organizations. And technology moves ahead in leaps and bounds. When I was a tech CEO, I was asked for very specific help by the government after 9/11. It had nothing to do with handing over citizens' personal information. It had everything to do with helping the government take advantage of the fact that we have the most sophisticated technological sector in the world. And I would ask the private sector to help us in that way again. The private sector has more sophisticated algorithms for how to search through big data than the government is using today. We ought to take advantage of the fact that we are the most sophisticated technological nation in the world. And one more thing.
Yeah.
When we are attacked in cyberspace, as we have been by the Chinese, the Russians, the North Koreans, the Iranians, we must retaliate. Because when we do not retaliate, more cyber attacks happen.
Another question related to this.
Retaliate
go ahead, Josh.
Well, for example, when the Iranians disrupt our infrastructure by tapping into our dams, we need to go do the same. When the Chinese steal the personal information of 23 million American citizens by hacking into the Office of Personnel Management, we need to respond with an attack that is equally substantial. It is the only way. If bad behavior occurs and we do nothing in response, we get more bad behavior. And that's what we're seeing around the world today.
Another question related to the high tech and national security field. You've often said, Ms. Fiorina, that your time in technology gives you foreign policy, national security experience. You talk about sitting down and meeting with world leaders while working in the field. Make that connection for us, please, how holding business meetings abroad translates into expertise in international crisis yes. management.
Well, first let me say that Hewlett-Packard, as well as AT&T, but Hewlett-Packard operated in about 170 countries. Let me also say that I've done charity and policy work in many places around the world. So, for example, I have been in a place like Saudi Arabia on multiple occasions, not just to discuss business, but to discuss education policy, to discuss charitable efforts. I've done business in China for decades. I have sat down and met with both allies like Angela Merkel or King Abdullah of Jordan or David Cameron, and I've also met with adversaries like Vladimir Putin. And I would classify China now as a rising adversary. It makes a difference when you have been in and around the world for decades. That's a different kind of experience than reading about it in a briefing book. And with all due respect, most politicians read about it. They haven't done it. They haven't been there. They haven't seen it over decades.
You're listening to a special First in the Nation primary forum on The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy, along with Josh Rogers. More with Carly Fiorina, Republican presidential candidate, in a moment. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today on The Exchange, it's another First in the Nation primary forum on The Exchange. Our guest today is Republican presidential candidate and former high-tech executive Carly Fiorina. We're also joined by a live audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. And let's go to that audience now. And thank you for being here. Please give us your name and go ahead and ask your question.
Good morning. My name is Katie. And my question is, why should an undeclared voter in New Hampshire vote for you, Carly, over your challenger?
Thank you, Katie.
Well, thanks for a great question, Katie. You know, the American people have found common ground. We know that the system isn't working anymore. We know that our country is headed in the wrong direction. 75% of the American people now understand that the federal government is corrupt. 80% of us believe we have a professional political class that cares more about the protection of its own power, position, and privilege than on actually getting anything done and solving these festering problems. We can solve our problems, but we have to go back to a citizen government. What does that mean? It means that we need to put more power in the hands of people and states and take power and money away from Washington, D.C. I'm running for the President of the United States because I think we can harness where Americans have found common ground to get that 73,000-page tax code down to 3 pages, to actually force government to justify every single dollar it spends, to be able to cut any dollar and move any dollar, to take back our education system so that instead of continuing to give more and more money to the Department of Education while we watch our education system continue to deteriorate, that we give states and parents and families and communities as many choices as possible so their kids have chances. These are things upon which the American people agree. And that's why I'm running for president. We need to take our country back.
All right, let's move to foreign policy. I want to ask about Saudi Arabia. That country recently executed around 50 people, including a prominent Shiite cleric, beheading them in a style most Americans would associate with the Islamic State. Let's take a listen to what you said about this on CNN.
We need to be clear that our role here is to try and tamp down this conflict. Saudi Arabia is our ally, despite the fact that they don't always behave in a way that we condone. Iran is a real and present threat, not only to Saudi Arabia, but to our other Arab allies and indeed to the United States' interests.
So if your role, is as you said, or the country's role should be to tamp down that conflict, tall order, how to do it?
Yeah. Well, first, let's not imagine that Iran's behavior is any better than Saudi Arabia's. In fact, Iran routinely executes and tortures its own citizens without any legal framework at all. So there's no doubt that Saudi Arabia's regime behaves in a way that we find reprehensible in many cases. It's also true that the President of the United States' role is to protect our interests. And Saudi Arabia has been a stalwart ally in this region for a long time. They are a very important player in defeating ISIS. ISIS must be defeated because ISIS is ruling right now with unbelievable savagery, crucifying, beheading, raping, selling into sexual slavery on a routine basis. We have to defeat ISIS. We cannot do that unless we deny them territory. Meanwhile, Iran is most definitely our adversary. And it's inconceivable to me that this administration would have signed off on the deal that it did. But it's even worse to say that less than 6 months after signing that deal, Iran goes ahead and, in direct violation of that deal, conducts 2 ballistic missile tests, and this administration does nothing about it, which is why for the next 12 months we're going to get more bad behavior out of Iran, out of North Korea, out of everybody. We, as the United States of America, have a very important role and a very important interest in maintaining stability in the Middle East, in pushing back on Iran's rising power, and in pushing back and defeating ISIS. And Saudi Arabia can help us in that regard.
But as far as defeating ISIS, you're not alone, obviously, in saying we need to work with countries in the region to help do this. But obviously, a lot of those folks don't get along terribly well among themselves. So how to build a coalition that will get the desired result? How would you do that?
Well, you're right. They don't always get along, unlike most other people running. I've spent a lot of time in that region. So I know, for example, that each of these nations has asked us for very specific things, support, to help them help us defeat ISIS. And this administration isn't providing it. So King Abdullah of Jordan, a man I've known a long time, King Abdullah of Jordan, you may recall, came to this country, was here, when the Jordanian pilot was burned alive in a cage. He was here because he was asking us for bombs and materiel for his Air Force, because he's conducting bombing runs against ISIS. We have yet to provide him with that bomb, those bombs, and that support. I will provide it. The Kurds have been asking us to arm them for 3 years. They are the most effective fighting force on the ground. Slowly, reluctantly, this administration has finally started to give them some arms, but they are going through a central government in Baghdad that no longer exists. I'll arm the Kurds. The Egyptians have been asking us to share intelligence with them for quite a long time. We aren't. I will. The point is, these allies will help us, but they need to see leadership and support and resolve from the United States of America, and they do not see it today. And worse, they see that we are siding with Iran, their implacable foe, and Russia, and so they don't trust us.
And as far as American troops go, where are you there?
We need to be more effective in terms of our bombing campaigns, which means we probably need more special forces on the ground. But ultimately, ISIS must be defeated by Sunnis. It is part of how we deny them legitimacy.
So much to talk about, Ms. Fiorina, and we could talk about this a lot more, but let's move back to our audience. We have a great audience here in Studio D from the Concord Young Professionals Network, and let's take another question from that audience. And good morning. Thank you for being here. Give us your name, please.
Hi, I'm David Testerman. I'm 11 years old, and my question was, what would you do to make sure that your administration honors and cares for our veterans? Mm-hmm.
David, thank you so much.
Thank you, David, so much, and David's a great example of homeschooling. You know, there is no greater stain on our nation's honor than how we care for our veterans. We remember the scandal in Arizona where we learned that veterans died waiting for appointments and bureaucrats were cooking the books. And the American people were so outraged by that that they put enormous pressure on Congress, and Congress acted, because Congress always acts under pressure, and passed a bill in 3 weeks that said you could fire the top 400 senior executives at the VA. Sadly, the pressure abated, and nothing's happened. We've only fired one person, and we learned recently that 307,000 veterans have died before they received health care, and the VA just handed out $142 million in bonuses for superb performance. This is a level of ineptitude and a lack of responsiveness that is a stain on our honor. So, I have spent a lot of time meeting with veterans. The first thing I would do is get past a second bill that's waiting on the House floor that says anybody in government can be fired for dereliction of duty, because you have to be able to hold people accountable. I don't enjoy firing people. Nobody does. But if there is no consequence for non-performance, and there is no consequence for non-performance in government today, you can do a great job or you can do a lousy job and there is no difference, then you're going to get bad performance over time. Secondly, having spent a lot of time with veterans, I would ask veterans, how do you want to be served? They know the answer to that. And that answer is a better blueprint for how to reform the VA than anything bureaucrats are going to come up with in Washington, D.C. This is an issue we have been talking about for 20 years. Politicians of both parties have talked and talked and talked, but nothing gets done. I'll get it done. And finally, and most importantly perhaps, I will be a commander-in-chief who values, honors, respects everyone who serves and everyone who has served.
Thank you, Sen, again, so much, David, for the question. We will be taking another question from our audience here in just a moment. You're listening to The Exchange on NHPR. Our guest today for another in our special first-in-the-nation primary forums is Carly Fiorina, Republican presidential candidate and former high-tech executive. And Josh Rogers, back to you for a question on the environment.
Sure. Your position on climate change is that while scientists say it's real and man-made, that a single nation acting alone can't make much of a difference, and that tackling this problem will cost trillions of dollars and decades of international cooperation. You don't seem to believe that there's much chance of that happening. So under a Fiorina administration, what would we expect from you on this front?
It is scientists who tell us that a single nation acting alone can make no difference at all. It is scientists who tell us that with current technology, it will take 30 years, trillions of dollars, and a coordinated, concerted global effort. There is no chance of that happening. And the Paris summit, which was, as our own president described it, an architecture for a plan, is not a globally coordinated effort that's going to be sustained. It was a lot of window dressing, frankly. What is the only way that we solve intractable problems? Innovation. And in order to innovate, and in order actually to make an impact on the environment today, we, the United States of America, need to be the global energy powerhouse of the 21st century for a couple reasons. One, because we need to have industries that are strong enough to innovate. Secondly, because all of our energy production is cleaner than everyone else's. Let me just give you an example. For 25 years, I know oil, fossil fuels are big and bad, but for 25 years, our oil producers have been prohibited from exporting oil. However, our oil, light, sweet crude, is cleaner burning than the oil that is exported by Russia, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia, and Iran. So here we are allowing, encouraging even, Iran, Russia, Venezuela, Saudi Arabia to export heavy, sour crude, which is far worse for the environment. And we're preventing our own producers from exporting light sweet crude, which is better for the environment. That makes no sense if you care about climate change. And if we care about climate change, we better talk about natural gas. We better talk about nuclear. We better talk about coal, because our coal is cleaner burning than China's coal. The point is, we need science. If we want to have science guide this conversation, then let's make sure it's science, not ideology.
So I'm interested in this idea of if we can't get the world together and it's going to take 30 years and cost trillions, I'm interested in this idea of innovation. So how can we, Ms. Fiorina, and this fits in with your high-tech background, how can we innovate our way out of this problem?
Well, so just as one example, there are a lot of people who have grave concerns, and I think most of them are ideologically based, about fracking. And yet, natural gas is demonstrably, scientifically, a far more cleaner burning fuel than oil. Here's another example of ideology interfering in science: the Keystone XL pipeline. Democrats, this president, has vetoed it, and yet that pipeline would be better for the environment than the way we are moving fuel today. Bureaucracies, by their nature, crush innovation. Because a bureaucracy, what? It's a hide-bound, tradition-bound, process-driven organization. What's innovation? It's risk-taking. So we have to have industries that are strong enough to innovate. So let's become the global energy powerhouse of the 21st century, which has the added benefit, by the way, of lowering energy costs for American families. And the bad guys, Russia, Iran, Venezuela,
don't use their oil or their natural
gas. Yes, we won't use their oil, and we won't be propping up their economies.
You know, clean air, we've certainly heard about asthma and air pollution. And boy, you know, China, they've got days where you don't even want to go out. There are those, Ms. Fiorina, and I know you know this, who say natural gas, yeah, it's cleaner. It's still a fossil fuel. It kind of gives us an excuse to put off the hard decisions, which is the truly clean, high-tech fuels of this century. I wonder what your thoughts are about that, that natural gas is being used as an excuse to put off what really needs to be done, which is 100% clean, renewable energy.
Well, you know, I think that's ideology. Look, it is not realistic. It is simply not realistic to say that we're going to power this nation or lift billions of people out of a dark world where they don't have access to power with solar and wind. That's not going to happen.
Or nuclear. Some people put that under.
By the way, I think we should be having a conversation about nuclear power in this country because it is a very clean burning source of energy. I think we ought to be talking about all of them. It's not that I'm against solar and wind, not at all. It's that realistically speaking, if we're honest with ourselves, they cannot power this nation and they cannot lift millions of people who are still in poverty and in darkness out of that poverty and darkness.
Let's take one more question from our audience of the Concord Young Professionals Network. And thank you so much for being here. Go ahead and ask your question.
Good morning, Bob Bennett. Question for you, hypothetically only. If your poll ratings remain low and you choose to remain in the race, what would you like to accomplish in the short term, in the long term, after the election?
Well, I don't answer hypothetical questions, but I will answer this question, okay? When I started this race, I was 17 out of 16. What I mean by that is pollsters didn't even ask for my name. And they didn't poll for my name because less than 3% of the voters had ever heard of me. And now here I am, tied with some pretty well-known governors who have spent millions of dollars on air. I haven't spent anything. So I actually have come further, faster than anyone imagined, and than anyone else. Here's the deal. Polls don't win elections. Voters do. Voters do. So while everybody obsesses over the polls, and while the media seems to think that it's its job to winnow the field, I actually think the voters of New Hampshire think it's their job to vet candidates and winnow the field. So let's see how I do here in New Hampshire, and let's see how I continue to do in the early states. But I think I've been underestimated by a lot of people. That's okay. I've been underestimated most of my life. I don't think the voters of New Hampshire, as they get to know me, underestimate me.
Go ahead, Josh. Last question for you.
Sure. I just want to ask a question. Obviously, you're the only woman running in the Republican side of things. And I know that you've, in some of your work prior to deciding to run for president, you were looking to ways with the Republican Party might, you know, sort of mitigate what we could call the gender gap. And, you know, how do you think the dialogue this year on the Republican side, you know, may affect that as we move along? I mean, do you anticipate that things are going to be better for Republicans with women come the fall than last time?
I think two things are going on. One, I think Hillary Clinton would very much like to avoid any discussion of her track record by talking instead about the historic nature of her candidacy. Secondly, I think we have on the Republican side a couple candidates who routinely insult women. As a woman, I find both of those things offensive. As a woman, don't like it when we talk about women's issues. The Democrat Party always wants to talk about women's issues. Women are 53% of the vote. We care about every issue. We're not a special interest group within the majority of the nation. So women care as much about education and energy and foreign policy and the economy as men do. Secondly, I think that I have never asked for people's support because I'm a woman, although I'm very proud to be one. I ask for voter support because I think I'm the most qualified candidate to win this nomination and to do this job. And finally, I think a lot of people want to see the debate between Hillary Clinton and I because they know in that debate we're not going to be talking about who's going to be the first woman president, although clearly we will have a woman president in that case. What we're going to talk about are the issues and our respective track records. And I look forward to that debate.
Well, and Ms. Fiorina, we know you can't stay for the full hour. We're so appreciative that you were able to give us this time. Thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
This is The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Laura Kanoy. We just heard from Republican presidential candidate Carly Fiorina. For the rest of the hour, we'll look more broadly at the GOP field, including what several candidates said this week here in New Hampshire. In addition to NHPR's Josh Rogers, I'm joined now by political analyst Dean Spiliotis of SNHU and author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And Dean, thank you for helping us out.
Sure. Good morning.
Well, we're 5 weeks now from the primary, Dean, and boy, it's been busy this week, right after the holiday weekend. Jumping right in, who's been here recently, Dean?
Most of the candidates have been here. You've had a number of candidates basically set up shop in the state. Donald Trump has been flying in every few days for rallies, as he likes to do. John Kasich and Chris Christie and Jeb Bush have been traversing the state. Obviously, Carly Fiorina is here. Marco Rubio is here recently. You can really feel the energy. This really is the final push now this last month. So voters are paying greater attention. The candidates are here. It's a good opportunity for people to really start to make their minds up.
And Donald Trump is still leading in New Hampshire primary voter polls.
Yeah, he's been comfortably in the 20s for a while now. He's in mid to upper 20s. And then you have this cluster of five people, two senators, Cruz and Rubio, and three governors, Kasich, Christie, and Bush, who are all now seem to be in kind of low double digits, between 10 and 15%. And Carly Fiorina, who we just heard, is in the mix, but at this point seems to be more sort of seventh or eighth in that grouping, depending on which poll you look at.
Well, and Donald Trump, as you said, you know, he's been here. He hasn't quite been pounding the pavement as much as some of
it's
the
not,
others,
yeah, but
it's
he's not
been
his
here.
Focus. He does the rallies, and then he gets out.
Let's hear from a Donald Trump rally held just this week in Claremont, New Hampshire. Here he is talking about voter fraud.
Look, you got to have real security with the voting system. This voting system is out of control. You have people, in my opinion, that are voting many, many times. They don't want security. They don't want cards.
Voter fraud. Has this been an issue so much in the Republican primary? It's definitely been an issue
in
state houses.
We've been talking about this issue for several years. It's been a real point of contention between Republicans and Democrats. Republicans have pointed to some anecdotal evidence that there's, you know, people are voting multiple times and there's voter fraud. Democrats have said that it's overblown. Donald Trump likes to sort of go big on these things, and he said there are, you know, many, many people voting many, many times. There's no evidence of that. There is some debate about these occasional anecdotal times where people are either caught or seem to be voting more than once. As you said, a lot of this is being fought at the state level where the rules around voting are set. And I think this primary is going to be the first time that people are going to have to show some sort of driver's license or identification or have their picture taken.
Josh, you were at that Trump rally. Anything else that jumped out at you from that Trump event?
Well, Donald Trump seemed to be having a very good time. It was a decent crowd in Claremont. There were probably about 1,500 people there. It was in the gymnasium of the high school, and the gymnasium backs up to the auditorium, so half the audience was looking at Donald Trump's back. He was sort of standing on a strip in the middle of the stage, and, you know, he's feeling pretty good about his chances at this point, here and elsewhere, and based on the polling, he ought to feel good. He's led every poll in New Hampshire since June, and he's releasing lists of names people who support him, some of whom have said, well, you know, I didn't expect to be on that list. But I, you know, talked to a lot of voters, and a lot of voters are both excited to vote for Donald Trump and, disenchanted with what they see as politics as usual. The thing to bear in mind with Trump, though, is that while he leads the polls, he's also the candidate that the greatest number of Republicans say they absolutely won't vote for. So, you know, there's obviously evidence that he's benefiting by having a kind of a clot of candidates. And you could put Rubio, Kasich, Bush, and Christie in this category, as well as some of the others potentially, who are fighting for a similar tranche of voters. Trump has his people. If the field thins at a certain point, you know, there's a chance that a more establishment person could, you know, scoop up some of the support and make this competitive. It's also going to be interesting to watch, obviously, what happens out of Iowa and whether or not a strong showing by Ted Cruz, who also holds some appeal among some of the Trump support, might slice some of that away.
That's the issue here in New Hampshire, is the size of the field. If you add up those five candidates below Donald Trump, it's almost 60% of the vote in the polls. So, you know, I don't know that it will thin before the primary. I think it will afterwards. Iowa might change things a little bit, but there are at least three or four of these candidates who are very heavily invested in New Hampshire, and they really are sort of make or break.
I want to ask both of you gentlemen about two candidates who have really invested a lot of time, as you say, Dean, here in the Granite State. One of them is Jeb Bush. And Jeb Bush, well, he got some attention for some comments that he made at a forum on opioid addiction on Tuesday. In fact, New Hampshire has really brought this issue to the forefront of the national presidential campaign. Let's hear from former Florida Governor Jeb Bush. Here he is at this forum sharing his personal story and giving his thoughts on why more people aren't involved with addressing drug abuse.
We need to eliminate the stigmas and the barriers so more and more people get engaged in this, where they're not embarrassed to say that I have an illness that I now am in the road of recovery on, or that I have a child who has a problem.
Dean, what do you think? This has gotten some attention, you know, former Governor Bush being very upfront about his own family's struggles.
Yeah, and this is something he's been talking about for a while. I think in general we've seen in both parties a heightened awareness of what's going on here in New Hampshire and also around the country. I think, you know, in the same way that people are talking about mental health issues in the context of gun control, people are also talking about needing more money to combat addiction and deal with the effects of the opioid crisis. So, you know, it's part of retail politics and being an effective candidate is trying to find a way to connect and with voters and to be seen as genuine and authentic. And, you know, talking about your family is one way to do that. I mean, there are times where sometimes it can be seen as manipulative, but I don't think that's the case here. I think he's being genuine about it and trying to find common ground with voters and particularly people in the state who have been sharing stories about their own families.
Well, and with Jeb Bush, it's interesting, too, because obviously his family, and when you think of his family, you don't think about his daughter who, you know, had a prescription drug problem. And so it's a way for him to invoke his family in a way that's potentially you know, less charged than invoking his father or his brother. But it is also true that on the campaign trail, it's interesting to listen, go to these a lot of recovery centers, and the topic of drugs has come up with a lot of candidates. And, you know, Chris Christie has anecdotes about his mother's, you know, addiction to smoking and his law school friend who ended up dying that have become real staples, anecdotes that he tells, you know, quite movingly. And, you know, the folks looking to make drug abuse an issue have done a good job of getting this issue out there, and it is no doubt a pressing public health issue in
New
Hampshire.
Bill Clinton just the other day when he was up here mentioned that he had several family friends who had children who had been either died or had been strongly affected by the crisis.
I think his brother Roger also had some issues too.
Brother Roger's also had issues over the years.
Well, it's interesting, and again, we heard from Jeb Bush, who basically has said New Hampshire is kind of it for him.
Pretty much. You know, he has a lot of money. You know, he may be able to stick around a little bit longer if he doesn't do well here. But I think people are looking for, at least among the governors, this sort of sub-primary to shake out a little bit, because all three of them have really staked a claim in the state. So I think the thinking is whichever one of them kind of does the best is going to get the most momentum coming out of here.
And you look at the Bush people would tell you, and obviously this is what campaigns tell you, that they have a very organized, methodical approach to voter contact, and that they've been working this. And, you know, they will also tell you that they've had to overcome the way in which Governor Bush doesn't necessarily come across on television as electrifying, and that they find that if they can get him in front of voters, that, you know, they may give him another look. Obviously, it's difficult for him. He was the last person who was leading polls before Donald Trump took over back in June. And, you know, Bush has been in a trough for some time. There are indications that he's potentially rising a little bit. But as Dean says, this competition between Kasich, Christie, and Bush in New Hampshire is very hard fought, and you know, it, obviously if those guys, I mean, the difference between coming in second and fourth, you know, assuming like they don't do something unlikely and win at this point, it could be vast for their fortunes down the road.
So the tenor of this race here in New Hampshire, Josh, has changed as this sort of cluster behind Donald Trump is duking it out to see who's going to be number two. It turns out number two could be really important.
Well, it's always important, but like, but you know, but it will definitely be important this year.
Well, let's hear what another person who's again, spent a lot of time here in the Granite State. Chris Christie, New Jersey governor. Let's hear what he had to say about this and more to the point that you raised, Josh, about, okay, I know this is all really important and we're all kind of fighting in this second cluster, but let's not fight too much.
But I'm here today to tell you, do not be fooled. Any significant division within the Republican Party leads to the same awful result. Close your eyes and picture Hillary Rodham Clinton on the front steps of the Capitol in January of 2017, taking the oath of office as President of the United States. This country cannot afford that outcome. And thus, we Republicans have a duty, I believe a profound moral duty, to work together.
Again, that's New Jersey Governor Chris Christie in a speech at St. Anselm College on Monday. What do you think about that, Dean Spiliotis? In the heat of a primary and the voting's not that far away, here's Chris Christie saying we have a duty, Republicans, to work together.
That's a time-honored argument on both sides. You know, you hear Republicans say for, you know, all the differences we have, any one of us would be better than the President Clinton or President Sanders. And the Democrats say, you know, we may have differences, but anything would be better than a President Trump or a President Cruz. So, you know, I hear that every cycle. You know, I think the subtext is we all, you know, Christie, what he's really saying is we all need to work together and coalesce behind my candidacy. I mean, that's the reality of what he's saying. But, you know, there is some truth to the fact that you could have this result where if this group of four or five all continue to get 10%, 11%, or 12%, they're all going to be loath to drop out. They're all going to be saying, you know, well, you drop out and I'll stay in. And, you know, I've heard a number of analysts refer to what's going on in the state as a circular firing squad. You know, Trump is firing at everybody and everybody's firing at Trump. And, you know, Rand Paul and Rubio are going at each other and Chris Christie is going at it with Jeb Bush. And that's part of the intramural aspect of politics when you're all closely packed like that. It's this sort of natural political behavior.
Well, we've been talking about candidates who've been here a lot. But Josh, what about the less frequent visitors like Ted Cruz or Ben Carson? We've talked before on this program about how those candidates tend to spend more time in Iowa because the Republican base there is more aligned with their political philosophy. But do these guys have any plans to campaign heavily in the Granite State, the Ted Cruz's and Ben Carson's of this race?
Ted Cruz is supposed to return next week, and I'm going to be very interested to see you know, how he fares here. It seems as if he's doing quite well in Iowa. And any candidate who comes out of Iowa, I mean, a non-incumbent has not won both Iowa and New Hampshire ever, I don't think. But if whoever wins Iowa does have a sort of slingshot effect into New Hampshire, I mean, I can recall, you know, even though, you know, Rick Santorum ended up winning Iowa last time, but we thought he hadn't won at the point when he came to New Hampshire, but we did know he'd come in a very close second at that point. And the difference between going to a Rick Santorum event prior to Iowa and after, and certainly part of that is just the week between Iowa and New Hampshire, everyone pays a lot of attention. But if Ted Cruz came out of Iowa with a head of steam, it would be interesting to see whether some of the support that is with other candidates would head his way. And, you know, the important thing for a lot of these candidates is to get a very strong result in one of the early states. And, you know, after the calendar does speed up, I mean, after you get to South Carolina, it's not very long until you've got a lot of voting. So you're going to need to do well someplace. And that's one reason why having a clotted field, you know, will we have people who are like, well, I came in fourth place everywhere and I'm sort of like limping into the South? You know, will people have the resources to do that? Some of them may.
You have the big March 1st, the big multi-state southern primary, which really I think will shake things out if it doesn't happen before that. You know, Ted Cruz is interesting because he's someone in Iowa who is connecting with evangelicals. The Republican caucus in Iowa is about 60-65% evangelical. When it comes to New Hampshire, you know, not a very religious state at all, not a big evangelical population, but he does connect really well with libertarians, free staters, Tea Party activists. So those are the folks. A lot of those folks like Donald Trump. And so he's going to – you've seen this sort of uncomfortable back and forth with him and Trump. Trump has now played the birther card and is – you know, suggesting that Cruz needs to go get a judgment from a court to suggest that he can be president because he was born in Canada to an American mother. So the constitutional idea of a natural-born citizen hasn't been tested in court. So he's sort of Trump is trying to kind of cast that as, you know, he's secretly Canadian, which means, you know, nationalized health care and weakening the dollar. I mean, this is sort of the subtext. But he has a knack for finding just the right thread to pull to throw these candidates off balance. So Cruz has kind of held his fire for the most part. But if he comes here after a strong showing in Iowa, particularly if Trump loses, I expect the two of them to really go at it.
What about Ben Carson? He's another one that is doing well in Iowa. I've seen actually a fair number of Ben Carson signs just around town here in Concord. What kind of a campaign is he running here in New Hampshire, Josh? We haven't seen a lot of him.
We haven't seen a lot. And, you know, he hasn't been here much. And he's had turmoil in his campaign nationally. He's had people quit. A lot of voters clearly find Ben Carson appealing. You know, it's hard to see him doing terribly well here, and it seems as if his fortunes are sliding everywhere. We'll see what he does in Iowa, but
could get that slingshot effect that you talked about.
The problem
Josh.
Is that the national security discourse that has started to dominate the Republican primary. He seems like he's like a fish out of water. He really is uncomfortable. Some of the stuff he says is just sort of a little odd. And it's really hurt him, I think, as these other candidates are all sort of ramping up their foreign policy credentials, including Carly Fiorina. It's just sort of very uncomfortable for him, and I think that has really, really hurt him.
Well, and one last question to you, Dean, because we didn't get a chance, just due to time constraints, to ask Ms. Fiorina. So as you guys have been describing, we've got Donald Trump still leading in the polls, if you believe the polls, although they've had their problems too. And then you have this sort of second-tier cluster where they're all duking it out, as you and Josh described. That second-tier cluster does not include Carly Fiorina. Yeah. What does she need to do in the next, you know, 4 to 5 weeks?
It's tough. I mean, she's in a very difficult spot, as you saw. You saw today, I think, why she gets strong reviews whenever she debates on television. She does not give ground easily. She tenaciously defends her record at Hewlett-Packard. She's a visceral critic of President Obama. She's a bit of a foreign policy hawk. I would put her behind that cluster, which is sort of seventh or eighth place. She's in a tough spot. I mean, she can continue with sort of the conservative business message, a foreign policy message, but they're just she had her moment in the late fall, early winter with those debates, and was unable to kind of sustain. She was up second or third place for a while here. So she's just in a tough spot. I don't see it happening for her, but I think she's a very interesting, as you saw, she's a very interesting, forceful voice in the discourse.
All right. Well, both of you, thank you very much for helping us out. Josh Rogers, NHPR senior political reporter, and Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar at SNHU, author of the website nhpoliticalcapital.com. And for this special First in the Nation primary forum, we'd also like to thank our audience from the Concord Young Professionals Network. Thanks, everyone, for being here. This is The Exchange on NHPR.